Today I want to start off by sharing with you a little story. You'll be very familiar with it because the story is very, very old. It was wrote by a gentleman who was named James Matthew Barry. He's just had his 150th birthday the other day, by the way. Had you been around to experience it? And the story that he wrote was called Peter Pan. The reason I want to tell you about Peter Pan is I want to look at the opening scene. We have Wendy, a young girl, Wendy Darling. She wakes up to find there's a boy crying in her bedroom. Being a sort of child who takes concern for others around her, she's got two younger brothers that need to look after, for example, she decides to ask him, why is he crying? Of course, he explains to her very quickly what the problem is. My shadow won't stay attached to me. It keeps flying off on its own and doing its own things. Well, Wendy has the answer for this problem. I'm quite good at sewing. I'll sew your shadow back to your feet. Then whatever you do, it'll have to do. And that's what she did, and that's how the story starts. For those of you who like to take not just notes, but an actual title, this sermon is going to be entitled The Shadow of Substance. Shadow of Substance. Today, we're going to look at what shadow and substance consists of. And I'm going to start off, unusually I suppose, by asking you to look up John 4, verse 20. John 4, verse 20. Now you'll notice that in John 4, verse 20, which is very familiar to all of you, Jesus has decided to stop at a well. It's called Jacob's Well. And as he's there, he meets a lady. He's on his own, for his disciples have went off to visit the nearby town to look for food, etc. And as he's there, she comes to the well and he says to her, can I have a drink? She's a bit confused as to why he, being a Jew and her being a Samaritan, why he would even approach her about this. And so she points out to him, just in case he's made a mistake and he didn't realise that she was Samaritan, rather than cause him an offence, she decided to point it out to him. But he explains to her that if she knew who he was, she would be asking him to give her water of life. Because the water of the well, you'll get thirsty again, but the water of life, you'll remain forever. When she realizes that this gentleman who she is talking to is a prophet, she feels that she could ask him a question. Her question is one that we should take note of. It's in verse 20. And she says, our fathers, now this is chapter 4, John chapter 4, verse 20. Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, but you Jews say that in Jerusalem is the place where one ought to worship. Verse 21. Jesus said to her, woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father. But then he says something which appears to be derogative. For you Samaritans do not know what you worship. But we Jews, we know who we worship. You see, here's an interesting concept. Jesus was highlighting and answering her question why there was a difference. And when we look at this, most of the time, we see that as a derogatory statement. Jesus made a number, or is recorded to have made a number of derogatory statements from time to time, where he belittled the lady, for example, who had come for her daughter, who's a Gentile, who had come for her daughter to be healed of a demon. He says, I can't give the children's food to the dogs, to the little dogs. And the lady turned around and pointed out to Jesus, yes, but even the little dogs eat the crumbs from under their master's table. And he then turned round and healed her daughter because of her faith. So this isn't unusual for Jesus. But here he's giving us a reason why. The Samaritans had been an imported people. They had come from other places, all across the Middle East and different places like that. And the custom was that when a nation took control and imported a people, they also provided instruction for how the people should worship the gods of that area. They never imported the gods of the land. They only imported the people. So when the Samaritan peoples were imported into Israel, they had to be taught how to worship the God of that place. The only problem was, there was a slight division between the Jews and the Israelites at that time. And the Israelites didn't actually worship God as they should. They had went after foreign gods and had set them up on the mountains. So the Samaritans were taught not how to worship God correctly. But they still knew that it was Yahweh that they were worshipping. They still knew that they had to offer sacrifices. They still knew about the law. But they were a wee bit peeved that they'd been told that you worship him in the mountains and in the hills, whereas the Jews were saying you worship him only in Jerusalem. But Jesus said, no, the hour has come. We're doing away with that. We're not going to have you worshipping either in the hills or in Jerusalem anymore. We're going to look at a new way. You see, in a sense, the Samaritans were a shadow of what had been the substance that the Jews believed. They had been a shadow. But as we know, the Jewish religion itself was based on a shadow of what was happening in heaven. We know this because we're told it. In Hebrews 8 verse 5, we're reminded that the earthly temple that was given, the directions of it that was given to Moses, were a shadow of the heavenly temple. So this was a shadow and substance situation. But what Jesus was telling this lady at the well is verse 23. The hour is coming and now is that the true worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth. What Jesus was doing here is he was looking at the law, which is shadow, and telling them that that shadow was no longer reflective of what God was showing to the people. He was presenting to them a new substance, and that substance was himself, Jesus Christ. Now the question is, and why I started with Peter Pan, is because we all know that the modern church today has a Peter Pan complex. You might say, how do we have a Peter Pan complex? Very simple. Jesus goes one way, and we, his shadow, his reflection, decide to go our own thing. We decide to follow our own path and worship him as we feel is right. And because we do that, we have this slight difficulty. We're having good fun, we're enjoying ourselves, but we're not with Christ. And that's a problem. That's the church in general. Wendy, in the original story, came up with a solution. Actually, sew the shadow back on. Sounds silly, doesn't it, really, when we think about it? But you know, that's exactly what God does. He takes us, the church, and he sews us to Christ. He combines us to Christ. The Bible uses different languages. It doesn't say he uses tread. It says that through the Holy Spirit, who Wendy's representing in this, through the Holy Spirit, we are united with Christ in fullness. And in another place, it tells us that Christ is the true vine and we are the branches. You see, at each aspect, we're reminded that we are the shadow of the substance, which is Christ. And that's what we need to understand. So, how does the substance work? Well, when Jesus came to this earth, he demonstrated that substance instantly impacts on all around it. If you were sick, he healed you. If you had a spirit, he cast it out of you. If you were dead, he raised you. If you had leprosy, he cleansed you. He did all of these things. If you were hungry, he fed you miraculously. If you were in a storm, he quenched it and stopped it happening. You see, the substance, who was Christ, actively changed everything that was around him that was in the shadow. Just like when we were driving up the road today, I had Phoebe in the car with me. And it was a lovely sunny day, and I pointed out to her, "Do you see all the shadows?" She says, "Yes." I says, "All those shadows have no real purpose other than they're darkened. So we can go straight through them because we have a substance." So we were looking at simple little things, highlighting here as we go along. But as a church, do we realize that individually, as the shadow, we have no substance as the shadow, and that the world, which is the first shadow, remember that Adam was made in the image of God, Adam and Eve both made in the image of God, the reflection of God, the shadow of God, yet they chose through disobedience to disassociate themselves with what God was doing. They decided to follow their own path, and this world, as we know, has been continuing to do that ever since. So, shadow and substance. But Jesus was telling them something else, this lady at the well. He was telling her that he could give her water to drink that would become in her a substance all of its own. Why is it a substance all of its own? Because she would never need to drink again. It would satisfy her thirst forever, for it would bubble up within her. It would, in fact, become drink to everyone she met. The Jewish laws, which were based on the pattern of what was in heaven, never was able to do that. It could only direct you towards something. But Christ, who is the substance, was able to bring everyone together under himself. So, if you're a shadow of substance, then you become a new creation. So you, the church, are a new creation. If you're a new creation, you're now a shadow of substance. That means that when Jesus returns to heaven and sits at the right hand of the Father, you can do what he did. Because you are the substance. Let me give you a few examples of this. When Jesus was active on the earth, from time to time he would walk into places like synagogues, you know, as you do. The problem was, in synagogues, you get people of all shapes, sizes, and backgrounds. But the thing was, they were all Jewish. They all believed the law. They all followed the truth. Yes, they were all in the synagogue. They were all doing what was right. So imagine the surprise when we read in the Bible that in the synagogue there was individuals who were demon-possessed. Why were demons in the synagogue? We might as well ask, why are demons attending church at times? But they do, because they want to hear and see what's happening. They want to hear and see what's happening. But when Jesus walks in, this is where it gets fun. Jesus walks into a synagogue, the demons see him. They don't see a shadow of God, which, you know, you're safe enough around a shadow, it's not going to hurt you. They see God. And we find in the Bible that it's recognized what they did when they saw God. They went into a panic. Have you ever seen a person in a car, usually not the driver, I love, sitting there, and all of a sudden somebody pulls out in front of them, and the car, the driver has to avoid a collision. The person beside them is generally, and I don't want to annoy anybody's ears, going, terrified. That's what happened to these demons when they met Jesus. And why? Because here they were faced with God. Here they were faced with judgment. Here they were faced with what was going to happen to them. The reality of the whole thing. So they were naturally a wee bit upset. When you become the substance, that's exactly what happens to you, with you. When you walk into a room or into a church or into a group setting where there is individuals who may or may not have either spirits influencing their lives or completely controlling them, the first thing that you see is all the spirits go quiet. They'll go quiet because they don't know who you are. But they can see Christ in you. The only problem is, and what they have to determine very quickly, is do you know Christ in you? Oh, you say, of course we know Christ in you. But that's not necessarily true. You might know he's supposed to be in you, but do you know he's in you? If they determine that you're not 100% sure, then they're very happy to settle in your presence and watch what you do and pick and poke and check and double check and look for ways to cause bother and difficulty until one day you get rid of them. That's how it works. In the New Testament, in the book of Acts, I think it's Acts 16 off the top of my head, there is a story that happened in Philippi. Paul and Silas were there, and there was no synagogue in this particular city. So they decided on a Sabbath to go down to the river where they thought any believers in God might be having a worship service, singing, praise of God, that sort of thing. So with that in mind, they headed down to the river. On their way, they pick up a lady who follows them and begins to make a proclamation. They don't know who she is. She's just a random. But this random is well known in her area because she has a spirit. Her spirit is not considered by the people to be a problem because they think it's very beneficial. She knows what's happening and who people are and what authority or strengths they have. And when she sees the apostles, she has to tell everybody. These are the servants of the Most High God. These men have the words that lead you to salvation. And she'd go on like this daily for as long as they were there. But you know what? Paul never said boo to her. Silas never said boo to her. She just continued doing what she was doing. Now one day, she overstepped the mark. We don't know what she did or how it happened, but she was just getting on Paul's nerves. And he turned around and he simply said, I command you to come out of her spirit, unclean spirit, and don't trouble that woman anymore. And she lost her ability to do that, to see the future or to know what was happening in people's lives or what was happening in markets. This caused a little bit of a problem, though, because she was very important to the financial sector of her city. And the reason she was so important to the financial sector of her city is, if you were in the market, you needed to know what shares were going up and what shares were going down. She was the lady who could tell you. Stock's going up here. It's going down there. This king's going to invade that king. He's not going to win. This king's going to overcome very quickly. He's going to take power. That decision is going to work you'll get a bigger crop out of that field than you would have with that field. But if you change the crop in that field, you'll get, you know, you can see why she was important to the people. Her owners, for she was a slave, were making a fortune out of her. I hit Paul. Just like a counselor. You see, the spirit in the woman had picked up a problem with the apostles. It wasn't that she didn't know who they were, because she evidently did. It wasn't that she wasn't afraid of them, she evidently was. But their reluctance to want to cast the spirit out was due to a misunderstanding which they had come aware of. And they literally weren't sure, because Jesus had told them, he had told the apostles, and I'm not just talking the 12, he had told all of them that were with him, that if an individual is working, casting out spirits, or healing the sick in the name of Jesus, even if he's not of our group, and that's how they put it, don't stop him. For if he's with us, he can't very well be against us. And this was a problem, because here was a demon doing it. It had found the loophole. Jesus was referring to people. But the Paul and Silas were unsure how they should approach this lady who was being influenced by a spirit. There was a difference. In time, it became clear that her work was causing problems in the church. It was causing deceit to set in. And the reason for that was very, very simple. You see, the substance of her teaching, remember, she is only the reflection, she's only the shadow of the true substance and the reason. So while it's saying, oh, these men are the servants of God, up until this point, when the apostles or the church spoke, only those who could hear the invitation from God were able to accept it. But when this woman spoke, every individual who could hear the enemy could hear her. And they knew she didn't tell lies. So they were all coming to the church. They were all making their commitment to God. But there were none of them invited to do so. So substance is very important for us to understand. This was a problem that occurred early on in the church, because the church didn't realize that when you see people, you are looking at a shadow of a spiritual substance. No matter who it is, every individual you will meet in this world is a shadow of one of two substances. The prince in power, or king of this earth, who we call Satan the devil, or Jesus Christ. You might say, well, I'm not sure, there's bound to be people who's neutral. No. You cannot have a shadow without a substance. You need to have substance for a shadow to be cast. And we are shadow. Mankind is shadow. This earth is shadow. That's why when Jesus came, he was substance, he could make such differences. He came in the middle of a storm to the disciples, walking on the water. Now, you don't have to be a scientist to know that if you want to try that, you might get wet feet. In fact, you might get more than wet feet, you might get drowned. But the whole point is, that's because a shadow, we're subject to the shadow. We're subject to what we see around us. Jesus, on the other hand, substance, was able to turn around and say, well, actually, you're subject to what I tell you. And I'm saying that you're solid under my foot. So he walked on the water. When the disciples see him coming towards them in the water, remember, this is a bad storm. They are really frightened. They think he's a ghost. They're confused. They're worried. But he shouts out, no, it's okay, guys, it's only me. don't know what you're worried about. It's only me. I know what they were worried about, but that's neither here nor there. But he doesn't see. He's saying to them, look, you've got to see past the shadow and look at substance. You've got to understand what's real. Peter, always one for, you know, proving things out, decides to address the problem directly. If you are Jesus, then invite me to come on the water to you. Now, we often say that Peter showed remarkable lack of faith when he started to sink in the sea. I think he showed remarkable faith stepping out of the boat to begin with. But that's just me. But you see, Peter knew one thing about Jesus. He knew that Jesus was God. He was the true substance. And therefore, whatever he said would occur. So he invited him. He said, tell me to walk on the water to meet you. And when Jesus said, come, he didn't say, well, are you sure you want to do this now? Do you really think you're up to this, Peter? No, he just said, come. And Peter steps out of the boat. He's looking at Jesus. He steps out of the boat. None of the rest of the disciples tried to stop him. He just didn't try to stop Peter. He's one of those people. Just let him get on with him. He starts walking towards Jesus. They're watching him walk towards Jesus. Then he lifts his eyes at Jesus and he looks at the wind and the waves and the storm. And you must understand, we're told this was a rough sea. So rough that hardened fishermen were terrified they were going to drown. So we're talking waves, and possibly he was looking up over. Do you understand? And when he started noticing the waves, and he started noticing the wind blowing him like out there, he began to wonder, what am I doing? I'm standing in the middle of the ocean. And the moment he started to think as shadow, he began to sink. He called, Jesus, help me! And Jesus was right beside him, reached out his hand, lifted him back up. The moment he touched Jesus, he was restored. He was able to walk in the water again. Jesus said just one thing, just one little statement. Why did you doubt? Put yourself in Peter's shoes. If Jesus had have asked you, why did you doubt? Under those circumstances, would you have had an answer? Yeah. Don't you see what's going on? But you see, the point is, what was going on in Peter's eyes, what he was seeing, was not the reality that he was experiencing. And that's part of the problem. We get mixed up between what we see and reality. So let's ask ourselves another way. Let's step away from Jesus for a minute and ask, has God ever worked with other people like this? Now, I'm brought to mind very quickly of a game of spiritual tag. Have you ever played spiritual tag? It's real good fun. God is the authorator of spiritual tag. It starts with a prophet by the name of Elijah. Elijah had basically felt that he was taking on the world by himself. There wasn't another prophet in the whole land who obeyed God. It was him versus everybody else. And he was tired. He was fed up. He wanted rest. So he was handing in his resignation to God. He was basically saying, I want to go home. I want to finish. I just can't do it anymore. Well, God said, okay. Then you need to go and get your replacement. His name's Elisha. And here's where you find him. So in 2 Kings, well, where is it? 1 Kings 19, verses 19 to 21. 1 Kings 19, verses 19 to 21. Did you say that fast enough? It's a bit like a tongue twister, isn't it? So he departed from there and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen before him, and he was with the 12. Then Elijah passed by him and threw his mantle on him. I said this was spiritual pig, didn't I? You ought to understand the rules of pig. The rule of the tig is there's somebody on it. But the moment they touch you, you're it. This guy's happily ploughing, minding his own business, ploughing with all his servants, his father's servants with him and all the rest, getting on with the work that has to be done. Prophet walks up behind him, throws a mantle on him and says, "You're it," and walks on. Imagine if that was to happen to any of you today. Imagine you're walking, say, in the middle of Belfast and somebody walks up to you, throws a garment over your shoulders and says, "You're it," and walks on. You'd want to know what's going on, for a start. But look what Elisha does. He left the oxen, ran after Elijah and said, "Please let me kiss my father and my mother and then I will follow you." And he said to him, that's Elijah replied, "Go back. For it's got nothing to do with me." It says here what I have done. What have I done to you? But it's really, it's got nothing to do with me. If you feel you want to do that, you do that. I don't care. You're it. It doesn't matter to me anymore. Do what you want. So Elisha turned back from him, took a yoke of oxen, slaughtered them, boiled their flesh, used the oak's equipment and gave it to the people, and they ate, and then he arose and followed Elijah and became his servant. Not a lot of thought went into this, was there? He just did it. By the way, he had 12 yoke of oxen, he only killed one. Just in case you thought he went clean mad. What did he do with him? He had a party. Everybody with him, he said, "Here, I'm going to a new job. I'm having a going away party here." And that's what he does, and that's what they're doing. Why do I bring up Elisha? Elisha had been asked to take over from Elijah. And Elijah taught him by allowing him to accompany him. So he didn't sit him down and say, "Right, here's what you'll have to do." He just gave him examples. And Elisha followed and watched. And that was it. That's all Elisha had to do. Follow and watch. Then one day, God made it clear to Elisha that Elijah was going to be taken away from him. So he followed and he followed and he followed and he refused to allow Elijah out of his sight. And then Elijah turned and said to him, "Okay, you know I'm going away. What do you want? What is it I can do for you before I go?" And Elisha says to him, "Give me 2 portions of your spirit." What Elisha had literally asked for gets confused at times. He didn't ask, "Take your spirit that's in you, Elijah, and split it into different portions and give me a portion, only double it." He said, "I want the spirit that's in you doubled in me. I want it twice the amount of what you have." This had never, ever been asked before, and that's why Elijah didn't know how to respond to him. He said, "Look, you've no idea what you're asking for. But if you see what happens to me, you will know that you've got exactly what you asked for. If you see." And they walked on, and Elisha saw a chariot of fire swoop down from heaven, separate Elijah and himself, and then saw Elijah being lifted up into the clouds in a chariot of fire. He saw. He didn't feel any different. He wasn't aware of any major impact in his spiritual abilities. But he knew that he had been told that if he saw that, he had twice the amount of spirit or substance than Elijah had. So he lifts the mantle that was lying on the ground, that had fallen off Elijah's shoulders as he was being taken up. He goes over to the River Jordan, that he had crossed. I think it was the River Jordan. It might have been brook, but it was water anyway. I'll not argue that point, please. He smit it, that is, he lifted it, and he just hit the water. The water separated, and he walked across dry-footed. So, he demonstrated that he had at least the same power. But then he began to do things differently. You see, Elisha understood something. He understood that in the shadow in which he lived, in the shadow in which he lived, which was Israel, not Judah, Israel, he was the substance of God on the earth. He was the substance of God. So he began to teach prophets. He began to bring people up. He began to get schools established. One day, one of the local schools discovered to themselves, you know, there's a lot of us. We're living in a place that's a wee bit small for us. We really need to move to bigger premises. No, they didn't go and have a fundraiser. I know that's what you all think they might have went and done, but they didn't. No fundraiser. Instead, they made a suggestion. Can we go and build somewhere else? So it was agreed. Each man would go and he would cut down one tree for wood to build a building. Each prophet, one tree. That was it. So away they went to do this. And they asked Elisha to go with them, and he did. He went with them. But you know what happened then? One of the younger prophets came to Elisha. He was in a real state. He says to Elisha, I've lost this metal axe, the iron axe head, and it's borrowed. I can't replace it. People will think terrible of me. What am I going to do? Now remember, Elisha is the substance. I'll tell you what he didn't do. He didn't immediately say, we all need to pray about this. That's the first thing he didn't do. We don't pray about this. He simply said, get a bit of wood. Throw it in the water where it is. Then lift it out again. The axe will be stuck to it. That's what he did. Do you see the difference? Here is a man who knows he is the substance. He is the substance, not shadow. And as such, he did what needed to be done. Now, I don't know about you, but we keep bringing back science here. How many people know that iron axe heads float to little bits of wood? Not one of you knew that. That's terrible. But you see, when substance has said it can happen, iron becomes lighter than water. That's a simple thing. By the way, you can search the Bible all you like, it only ever happened once. I'm not saying it wouldn't happen if you needed to. I'm just saying, do you have the substance? But here's the problem. Here's something I need you to understand. I've been looking and explaining to you about substance and shadow. When Jesus Christ returned to the Father and gave us the Holy Spirit, the disciples were sitting in the upper room shadowing, shadows of their former self in a sense, because they were not happy. They were worried about what was going to happen to them. They had no desire to do anything except go home and hide. But when the Holy Spirit fell on them, that changed. They became individuals who became the substance of Christ to all who met them. How important is this? Well, look at it this way. It got to a stage where people didn't bother asking Peter to pray for the sick or to lay hands on them. They just figured out, we gotta get Peter to go this way, because if his shadow can hit the people that we lay out, they'll be healed. And that's exactly what happened. He became substance. We know the same thing happened with Paul. He became substance. Every time we meet somebody in the New Testament who is obedient to Christ, they become the substance, not the shadow. The shadow has no power. The shadow can do nothing. But you, the church, are substance. So, with that in mind, let's go do something for God. We'll start, very simply, by accepting that what Jesus told us is true. And if he's told us it, then it's true, and we just make it happen in our lives. Thank you.